Tuesday was the 60th day of the Israel-Hamas war. Israel is said to be intensifying its military operations.
Now, Israel says that overall about 5,000 Hamas fighters have been killed in the fighting with Israel.
Plus, strikes have resumed in full force in the Gaza Strip as the war between Israel and Hamas approaches its third month.
More than 40 kilometers from the Gaza Strip, rockets can still fire at Israeli cities or bases. Most are shut down by the Israelis' famed defense system.
And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday said that Gaza must be demilitarized. Today is Wednesday, December 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday said that Gaza must be demilitarized.
Gaza chayevet liyot mefurezet.
He says there is only one force that can enforce that demilitarization. That force is the Israeli military. No international force can be responsible for this. We've seen what happens in other places when international forces were brought for the goal of demilitarization. I'm not ready to close my eyes and accept any other arrangement. The Prime Minister's remarks came as Israel's military said its troops had entered Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, in its pursuit to wipe out the territory's Hamas rulers. Tuesday was the 60th day of the Israel-Hamas war. Israel was said to have been intensifying its military operations. I spoke with VOA's Middle East correspondent, Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem, who gives us this update on the Israel-Hamas war.
So Khan Yunis is surrounded by Israeli army tanks, but Israel has not yet gone into the center of the city, which is the second largest city, and also is even more crowded because a lot of Palestinians from northern Gaza have fled to Khan Yunis. Now, Israel says that overall about 5,000 Hamas fighters have been killed in the fighting with Israel, but that still leaves at least 20,000 Hamas fighters, most of whom are believed to be hiding in underground tunnels and waiting for the Israeli army to get there.
You speak of the tunnels, and we've talked about this in the past, that they have an elaborate network of tunnels to operate in and hide in. Now, what efforts are Israel's military making to destroy these tunnels or making them at least less accessible for Hamas to use?
In the past, in 2014, Israel went into the tunnels and there were a lot of Israeli casualties in this close fighting in the tunnels. So Israel is trying to figure out a way to seal off the tunnels without having to send people in. First of all, they sent in robots that show the structure of the tunnel. They've also, one idea is they've set up some pumps near the tunnels where they believe the tunnels are, and they're thinking about flooding them with seawater. There's also there's something new called the sponge, which is some kind of new material that you've put inside the tunnels and it expands and seals off the tunnels. So Israel says it does have solutions, but it first has to find those tunnels. Now they say they found 800 shafts that lead to tunnels since the fighting began 2 months ago, but they believe that there are thousands of others.
Linda, I've been hearing that the humanitarian crisis is worsening in Gaza.
Yes, the humanitarian crisis is worsening in Gaza. Israel is allowing humanitarian aid to come in. Hamas is apparently diverting some of that aid. There was a video shown on Israeli social media networks, and again, it's always hard to know how true these things are, but the video showed Hamas gunmen trying to divert a shipment of fuel and Palestinians in Gaza yelling at them and even throwing stones at them. So Israel has long said that Hamas diverts some of the humanitarian aid for its own uses. Israel has ordered Palestinians to leave northern Gaza. Over a million left. They've now crowded into southern Gaza. I actually texted with someone I know there who's with her mother, and she said they had been in a school, in a UN school in Khan Yunis, and they decided that that wasn't safe anymore, and they moved today, and she said that they don't have enough food, they don't have enough medicine, and that the situation is really extremely difficult in Gaza.
That was VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Strikes have resumed in full force in the Gaza Strip as the war between Israel and Hamas approaches its third month. United Nations officials say that more than 5,300 children have died in the conflict. In the desert outside of Gaza, VOA's Heather Murdoch meets a Bedouin family mourning the loss of their children killed by bombs aimed at the warring parties.
More than 40 kilometers from the Gaza Strip, rockets can still fire at Israeli cities or bases. Most are shot down by the Israelis' famed defense system. But some landed here, in a village in the desert near the Israeli city of Be'er Sheva. The village is unrecognized by the government and sparsely populated by Bedouin families. They are neither Israeli nor Palestinian, but they are in the line of fire. Four children died when this man's yard was hit, including two of his sons.
It happened on a Saturday. We were safe until 6 in the morning when the first missile hit. The whole family woke up from the noise and we gathered. So everyone was saying thanks for being alive.
After 40 minutes, as the adults discussed the attack, another rocket landed, killing two 16-year-old boys and two 11-year-olds. They were two of Ibrahim's sons and two of his nephews. And after 2 months of war in Gaza, thousands of children are dead. UNICEF says Gaza is once again the world's most dangerous place to be a child. And as battles resume in force after a week-long ceasefire, hospitals in Gaza are overwhelmed, without the resources or even safe places to treat the injured. During the 7-day break, more than 100 hostages held in Gaza were released, including 30 children, according to UNICEF, while Israel released about 240 detainees, nearly 45% under 18 years old, according to the New York Times. But the ceasefire ended with renewed attacks in Gaza and a new round of skyrocketing deaths. UNICEF says they expect hundreds of children to die every day. Neither side has shown a reason for hope for another ceasefire soon. In Israeli cities and towns, in the occupied West Bank, and here in villages between the two, residents say despite the conflict, or sometimes because of the conflict, they are determined not to leave.
We thank God and we will not run away. We are part of this place and we will remain here until God's will.
He says this land lies between an Israeli city and a military airfield, but it is far enough from both that he cannot guess where the rockets that killed his sons were aimed. His children, he emphasizes, were no more involved in the making of this war than the children in Gaza. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, outside Be'er Sheva in Israel.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky unexpectedly canceled a scheduled video link appeal to U.S. senators Tuesday as Washington is set for a showdown on funding for the war with Russia. House Republicans, meanwhile, are sticking to their demand for sweeping border security changes in any deal for more aid to Ukraine. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It was a hard line. Message from Speaker Mike Johnson at a closed-door GOP meeting. A Republican in the room says Johnson declared big border policy changes would be their hill to die on. In talks over the Biden administration's nearly $106 billion aid package for the wars in Ukraine and Israel and other security needs. Moments later,
the battle is for the border. We do that first as a top priority, and we'll take care of these other obligations.
Johnson's remarks came out hours before Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was to appeal to senators for more aid, with Democratic Chief Chuck Schumer expecting a blunt message.
Without more aid from Congress, Ukraine may fall.
The administration says it will run out of funding to send Kyiv weapons and other help by year's end. Sagar Magani, Washington.
We're also following these stories from around the world. 11 more bodies have been discovered, bringing the death toll to 22 following the eruption of Indonesia's Mount Merapi. Two bodies were found on Monday, with 9 more discovered on Tuesday, according to the National Search and Rescue Agency in Jakarta. Parts of Germany remained under a thick layer of snow on Tuesday, with Bavaria's capital, Munich, particularly affected. Tram service was halted on all routes by tracks covered with snow, while residents nearby were seen with shovels digging out access to their blocked garage entrances. Cyclone Megjam barreled into the southern Indian coast on Tuesday with intense winds. Its arrival was preceded by torrential rains and flooding that killed at least 13 people, as officials assessed the damage. At some point, winds reached 110 kilometers per hour, but the cyclone weakened to cyclonic storm intensity by the end of Tuesday, maintaining its strength for several hours. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Four Republican presidential candidates will take the stage to face off with each other in the fourth and smallest debate yet, Wednesday night. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie have qualified for the debate in Alabama. VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, about the final four candidates.
John, before we talk about the upcoming debate on Wednesday, former President Donald Trump is once again skipping the debate, instead appearing on a Fox News town hall on Tuesday and holding a private fundraiser on Wednesday. So what are Iowa caucus goers saying about this? I think some of them are saying that perhaps that he should participate in at least one of the debates.
Well, President Trump is acting and even saying that he is essentially an incumbent. He's like the sitting president, Joe Biden. He is so far ahead in the polls and is the leader that he doesn't need to debate at this point. And he's skipped all the debates. You know, I think that's worked for him so far in the sense that he has maintained his lead. The question will be, for a place like Iowa, which is a personal place where people get invested, and it's the first contest and people attend the caucuses in person, and some candidates spend a lot of time there, whether some voters will wish that he was out debating the other candidates more directly. But we haven't seen evidence in the polls that so far that has affected his standing either in Iowa or the nation.
Looking at the debate on Wednesday night, what are your expectations? It appears as if the four candidates are all going in very confident.
Well, I think we have seen a narrowing of the field. There are fewer candidates and fewer serious candidates. Again, the leading candidate is not there, but certainly Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley, I think, are clearly the two candidates and ones who think they might be able to score some early victories or at least do very well early on, with Ron DeSantis hoping that he might be able to do very well in Iowa. And then Nikki Haley, perhaps in New Hampshire. And so in some ways, it's a battle between the two of them to see who might be the alternative to Trump. But he's not there directly, and they still trail a fair amount. So I think those two are the ones to watch.
Also, Vivek Ramaswamy told reporters in Iowa on Saturday that he intends to bring the same, quote, candor, unquote, to the fourth debate as he has to past debates. Does he need to change anything about his presentation?
Well, I think his presentation is varied. It's sometimes been very, very aggressive and other times less so. I think he's looking to be more aggressive again. You know, his standing, he rose somewhat high early in the polls, not dramatically high, but certainly came out of obscurity to being someone who did well in the polls. And then he's fallen back. So I think for Vivek Ramaswamy, he's got to find some sort of formula to really be considered one of the top candidates. At this point, I think of the candidates at the debates, DeSantis and Haley are clearly one and two, and the others are really struggling to keep up with them.
That was VOA's Kim Lewis speaking with John Fortier of the American Enterprise Institute. Nelson Mandela was a global icon who inspired the world. He spent 27 years in prison in his fight against South African apartheid, and in 1994 was elected South Africa's first black president. Kate Bartlett reports that 10 years after Mandela's death, former comrades, family, and analysts say he would be disappointed at the state of South Africa today.
Nelson Mandela, arguably the world's best known and most beloved South African, died a decade ago on December 5, 2013, at the age of 95. His greatest achievement was bringing freedom and democracy to South Africa with his African National Congress, or ANC party, after decades of brutal white minority rule. He forgave his former enemies and ushered in one of the world's most progressive constitutions. South Africa was seen as a moral example and beacon of hope worldwide. Mandela served one term in office. Even before his death, however, while he was in retirement, his once-storied ANC had become embroiled in corruption scandals, most notably under one of his successors, former President Jacob Zuma. Today, critics accuse the party of only caring about self-enrichment and failing to deliver a better life for most of South Africa's impoverished citizens. They say Madiba, as he was widely known, would have been disappointed.
He would have been absolutely appalled at the decay in the country, the continued rampant corruption, including by some cabinet ministers who are members of his once proud African National Congress.
That was Peter Hain, a friend to Mandela and noted anti-apartheid activist whom apartheid security forces attempted to assassinate with a letter bomb in 1972. Many other ANC stalwarts and surviving Mandela contemporaries declined to comment for this story. However, one of the statesman's grandsons, Indaba Mandela, echoed the view that Mandela would have been disappointed.
Of course, my grandfather Madiba would have been very disappointed, to say the least, to see what's happened with the current ANC, with his party that he loved so much. Do I think some of the party members are letting down the ANC? Of course they are. You have ministers who are on a feeding frenzy.
Lumkili Mondi, an economics professor at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, described what he said are the main problems facing South Africa today.
Levels of unemployment are very, very high at about 32.5. More importantly, inequality has deepened. So is poverty. Infrastructure, whether it's water infrastructure, roads infrastructure, electricity infrastructure, has collapsed.
Next year marks 30 years since the first democratic elections in South Africa, and voters will head to the ballot box once again. Numerous polls are suggesting the ANC will lose its majority for the first time. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A credit ratings agency has downgraded China's credit ratings because of its slowing economy and faltering real estate sector. VOA's Kim Lewis has more.
U.S.-based Moody's Investor Service says it lowered its outlook for Chinese government-issued bonds Tuesday from stable to negative because of the huge debt carried by local and regional governments and state-owned enterprises. Moody's also cited the crisis in China's once-booming property sector, with major developers defaulting on billions of dollars of loans and bills to small businesses and other contractors, leaving hundreds of housing projects unfinished. Kim Lewis, VOA News.
The COP28 climate summit in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, is getting heated as leaders debate on how to rein in global warming, amid accusations that the hosts have invited a record number of lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Some 70,000 delegates are attending the United Nations COP28 climate change conference. Politicians, scientists, campaigners, advocating a myriad array of interests and ideas. But the focus appears to be narrowing on a key question. Do we need to ban fossil fuels outright? Coal, oil, and gas are blamed for much of global warming, but are also the driving force behind many economies, including that of summit host United Arab Emirates. The latest figures show 2023 is expected to be a record-breaking year for global carbon dioxide emissions. Professor Corinne Laquere is a climate scientist at the University of East Anglia.
The growing emissions year on year are responsible for climate change. And as long as they're not brought down to zero, then the warming is going to continue.
Research from a coalition of environmental groups suggests more than 2,400 delegates at COP28 are connected to fossil fuel industries. Eric Njuguna is from the Kick Big Polluters Out Coalition.
This is seven times larger than Indigenous Peoples delegation and a four times increase from last year's 636 delegates who were lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry.
Scientists say greenhouse gas emissions need to be slashed by 43% over the next 6 years. But current trajectories suggest emissions will actually rise by 9% over that same time span. Again, Eric Njuguna.
And that is why at COP28, we need a strong commitment to phase out all fossil fuels, not just coal, not just unabated fossil fuels, but all fossil fuels, including oil, gas and coal.
Others say that's unrealistic, and fossil fuels will have to be part of the energy mix, alongside innovations like carbon markets and carbon capture. Current COP28 President Sultan Al Jaber is also head of the United Arab Emirates state-run oil company, which plans to increase production substantially by 2030. He wants a phasing down of fossil fuels rather than a phasing out, insisting that this is the only way to rein in global warming while allowing for development. Facing a barrage of criticism, the COP president defended his stance Tuesday.
I am quite surprised with the constant and repeated attempts to undermine the work of the COP28 presidency and the attempts to undermine the message that we keep repeating when it comes to how much we respect the science.
That has done little to placate his critics. Climate activist and former U.S. Vice President Al Gore.
We cannot play games designed to protect the obscene profits of these oil and gas petrostates.
COP28 has got off to a heated start. Observers say the hosts face a tough challenge to oversee negotiations towards a final declaration, with the spotlight so firmly fixed on the summit president himself. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of the roughly 240 people kidnapped by Hamas in the October 7th attack on Israel, some 110 have been returned. During the humanitarian truce that came into force on November 24th, at least 10 hostages were released every day. But hopes that the remaining prisoners would be freed in the coming days were dashed when fighting resumed on December 1st. We remain intensely focused on getting everyone home, getting hostages back, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken after the truce broke. We're also very much focused, as we've been all along, on trying to make sure that this conflict doesn't spread, that it doesn't escalate in other places. Indeed, that is one of three major concerns going forward, said United States Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield.
In particular, the United States does not want to see conflict in Lebanon, where escalation would have grave implications for regional peace and security and for the well-being of the Lebanese people. Restoring calm along the Israel-Lebanon border is of utmost importance.
Second, we are deeply troubled by the sharp rise in violence by extremist Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the West Bank, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
Extremists that attack civilians in the West Bank must be held accountable, and this violence must stop. And President Biden has made clear that the United States is prepared to take action, including by issuing visa bans against these extremists. We strongly oppose the advancement of settlements in the West Bank, which undermines the possibility of a contiguous Palestinian state.
Third, we call on all parties in the region and people around the world to refrain from inflammatory rhetoric that exacerbates tensions and hate, she said.
That includes dehumanizing language. Over the past 2 months, we've seen a spike in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. We see this playing out online, across social media, and we also see it in our communities, where hate begets violence.
Even as we focus on the immediate task before us, we must look forward to a better future, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. We need a two-state solution, where Gaza and the West Bank are reunited under a single governance structure, ultimately under a revitalized Palestinian Authority. This is the only guarantor of a secure and democratic Israel. This is the only guarantor of Palestinians realizing their legitimate aspirations to a state of their own. This is the only way to end this cycle of violence once and for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.